Thank you all. Please be seated. All right. We have one matter for argument today. The panel that will be hearing this matter consists of myself, Wade Birdwell, then to my left, Justice Dana Womack, and then to my right, Justice Dabney Basil. And so if the clerk will call the matter for argument, we'll begin.
The court will now call number 02-24-209-CR, Rachelle versus State of Texas. May it please the court, Ms. Heather M. Lytle will argue for the appellant. Mr. Joshua Llewellyn will argue for the state.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court and counsel for the state. My name is Heather Lytle, and it's my honor to represent Carlos Rachelle before you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this case this afternoon. I intend to focus on points of error 2 and 3, not to say that I don't believe the other points of error have merit, and certainly if the court has questions about any matter raised, I'm happy to answer those. In point of error 2, the trial court reversibly erred because it refused to exclude touching the breast of a child from the jury's consideration of acts of sexual abuse in application paragraph for count 1, which is continuous sexual abuse of a child. And from here on out, I'll probably just refer to that as CSA because that's a lot less words and a little bit easier to reference for all of us. So as we know, CSA occurs when a person commits 2 or more acts of sexual abuse over a period of time that is 30 or more days in duration. And an act of sexual abuse includes aggravated sexual assault of a child and also indecency with a child, except for touching the breast of a child. The statute specifically excludes that act from consideration when a jury is considering whether or not to convict someone of CSA. And the abstract portion of the jury charge in this case correctly defined each of the statutes that are applicable here. Correctly defined CSA, correctly defined acts of sexual abuse, correctly defined indecency with a child. But the application paragraph, the part that is the heart and soul of the jury charge, because it tells the jury how they are authorized to either convict or acquit, it failed to correctly inform the jury of the law that is applicable to the facts that they heard in the case, because it told them specifically that they could convict Mr. Rachelle if it found that beyond reasonable doubt that during a period of time, just 30 days or more in duration, he committed, quote, 2 or more acts of sexual abuse, including an act or acts of sexual abuse constituting the offense of aggravated sexual assault of a child, or an act or acts constituting the offense of indecency with a child. The offense of indecency with a child. So if the jury then would look back to see what the offense of indecency with a child is. An indecency with a child allows for conviction if a person touches the breast of a child, but CSA does not. And there's no part of the application paragraph that refers the jury back to the definitions. There's no statement that says acts of sexual abuse as previously defined.
It does specifically define sexual abuse, though, does it not?
In the abstract
specifically says sexual abuse does not include the touching of a breast.
That's true, Justice Birdwell. And I would argue that even though that's true, that doesn't suffice.
The state cites the Diaz and the Lopez cases out of Corpus Christi. Your reply brief doesn't mention them. Why do you think they don't apply in this case?
Well, both of those cases are unpublished and don't have precedential value. Also, Diaz is distinguishable on its facts. The application paragraph in that case did specifically refer jurors to acts of sexual abuse as that term has been previously defined. That statement's not found here in our case. Lopez is a similar case. It's a remarkably similar. I would argue that this court is not bound to follow it, because it has no precedential value.
Why is it wrong, whether we're bound to follow it or not?
I think it's wrong for the same reason that it's wrong here, because the jury, that case is similar. It said, you know, if he committed acts of aggravated sexual assault or indecency with a child. I think Lopez was wrongly decided, just like this jury charge is wrong, because the did not specifically tell the jury. It basically gave them a different definition in this case, that a different definition of the law that they could apply the facts to that is different from the abstract portion. The state relies on Vasquez v. State for the proposition that trial court's not required to cut and paste in the application paragraph, and that's true. And I agree that Vasquez is controlling here. But the previous portion of the Vasquez opinion, that it says when a definition or instruction on a theory of law is given in the abstract, the application paragraph must specify all of the conditions to be met before a conviction under such a theory is authorized. It must authorize a conviction under conditions specified by other paragraphs of the jury charge to which the application paragraph necessarily and unambiguously refers or contains some logically consistent combination of such paragraphs. If the application paragraph does that, then Vasquez says the jury, we are not going to hold the trial court to cut and paste if it meets those requirements. And in this case, it doesn't. It simply says you can convict Mr. Rachel of CSA if you find he committed two or more offenses of aggravated sexual assault of a child or offenses of indecency with a child, period. So the jury then looks back to see in the abstract paragraph, what is an offense of indecency with a child? Well, that includes touching the breast of a child. Mr. Rachel's attorney asked the trial court to edit that part, to specifically exclude it so that the jury's not confused, because it is a little bit confusing. Indecency with a child includes touching the breast, even over the clothes of a child. That is not, though, an act of sexual abuse that can be considered in a CSA offense. Mr. Rachel was also charged separately with indecency with a child. So here it's confusing because they overlap and some exclude and some don't. It was incumbent upon the trial court to make sure that the jury understood exactly what scenarios and what law they were required to follow before convicting Mr. Rachel of anything.
So your argument is there are two definitions of indecency in the abstract portion of the charge and the jury didn't know which one to apply.
Yes, that is a much more succinct way of saying that. Thank you, Justice Basil.
So we still have to determine whether or not there was harm under the circumstances, do we not?
Yes, and I believe it was harmful in this case. As we know, Mr. Rachel did object, and so this court will reverse if there's some harm. We know that that has to be theoretical. I mean, can't be theoretical, I'm sorry. Must be actual harm. But we also know that the Court of Criminal Appeals has said we don't have to say, in order to find some harm, that the jury absolutely relied on the wrong portion. It's enough that they could have, even if the law is correctly defined elsewhere. In this case, the harm is the most apparent when we look at the arguments of the state just prior to jury deliberation. They talked about when they were talking about, you know, hey folks, we're outside of 30 days. He was in her life for a year and he did all of this stuff. And he said, remember her testimony. Something inappropriate happened every weekend, a butt touch, touching her breast, putting his mouth on her vagina, pushing her head down, or remember him discussing him prying her lip open. So, and then right after that, they go into what's appropriate, what acts to consider for conviction on a CSA. So the state is telling them you can consider all of it, everything we've heard, including touching her breast. So
there was no argument during closing argument that specifically told the jury, pointed them to the abstract, saying that you can consider all of this except you cannot consider touching of the breast, or Is this the only mention of touching of the breast with regard to closing argument?
That's not the only mention, Judge, but there was no specific mention of when you're looking at count one, jury, you can't consider touching of a breast.
But they did during voir dire, during jury selection, they did specifically say that, did they not?
They did specifically say, hey, take it up with the legislature, that they excluded this part from CSA.
I think you actually said it was fun.
Yeah.
Which was a little jarring, but anyway.
I could certainly understand the state's frustration at that weird exclusion.
We have our own critique of the legislature quite often, but I would never use the word fun in being critical of the legislature. So anyway.
The prosecutor did explain that difference briefly in voir dire. The argument here is that that doesn't overcome the error. A prosecutor's explanation of the law in voir dire doesn't overcome the judge's instruction on the law, which the jury is required to follow. We all know anything that we lawyers say in a courtroom is not evidence and it's not law. But what a judge says is. And so when a judge gives an instruction, the jury is bound, and they're also instructed in the charge, you must follow what I'm telling you. What lawyers have said is not the law. So if what the judge told them was different, then the jury is bound to follow what the judge said. And what the judge said was, you can convict him of CSA if he committed two acts of indecency with a child. And that's just not the law. And so it's my position that even though the abstract was correct, that's not enough in this case. And it doesn't matter if the abstract is correct, if the application paragraph doesn't point them to the correct portions of the law. If there are any more questions about that, I will move to point of error three. Before I start this, I want to say, I really dislike raising ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal. It is not fun for me, Justice Birdwell.
Is that word again?
Yeah. It is not fun to criticize a colleague, especially at this stage of an appeal. But this was an especially jarring, again, to use your word, Justice Birdwell, thing that occurred at trial. The victim was on the stand. She was the first witness for the state. In the middle of her cross-examination, the trial court took a break, the lunch break. When they came back, a local defense attorney came to the court and said, I overheard some jurors talking at lunch. They were talking about the testimony. They were referencing whether or not he would testify. And the trial court intended to do what was appropriate, was going to bring, they determined first, it was in fact the jurors on Mr. Rachel's case. The trial court was going to bring them out and question them, admonish them for violating the rules. And defense counsel said, no, don't question them. Don't find out if they were already decided. Don't find out why they were referencing whether or not my client would testify. Just tell the whole panel, hey, don't talk about this case anymore. And in my opinion, even though I understand and will concede, direct appeal is not normally the correct vehicle for ineffective assistance of counsel. But it can happen, and it can be appropriate when there's no conceivable, reasonable strategy, trial strategy, for doing so. And the state has said, well, he didn't want, it's reasonable because he didn't want the jury to be aggravated at him. That's not a reasonable trial strategy. Because
why isn't that a reasonable trial strategy? We're dealing with
why is a ticked off jury not a reasonable trial strategy?
Because the trial court would be the one admonishing, not counsel. The court was not even going to allow any attorney to speak to the jury. It was going to be the trial court saying, I have evidence that this happened and I need to find out why. Because more important than a jury being aggravated is Mr. Rachel having a fair trial. And we have evidence of at least two jurors who have already violated the rules. The rebuttable presumption goes to Mr. Rachel is harmed already before the trial court even brings them out. So whether or not they are irritated at having been found out and admonished by the court to follow the instructions does not mean they were irritated at Mr. Rachel for that. Mr. Rachel was not the one who brought that to the trial court's attention. Mr. Rachel's counsel was not going to be the one to question them about that or grill them or somehow cross-examine them. That was going to be up to the trial court, as is appropriate. It was his courtroom and his rules that the jurors violated, and that's not in question, that they violated the rules that the court had given them. So it's not reasonable to simply ask the court to re-admonish them. They'd already broken the rules. Why is it reasonable to assume that they would follow them after being admonished one more time? So we're left with...
I mean, there's a distinct possibility these people weren't going to be kicked off the jury, and this lawyer is spinning out in his mind, do I open my mouth, do I shut my mouth? And apparently he decided that he was going to take a path of least resistance here. I'm still having trouble seeing why that's not a judgment call on his part at that point in time.
I see that
you've got an additional minute to do that, and we'll add a minute to the state's time.
Thank you, Justice Bergwell.
One additional add to that, and that is, were there any alternates on this jury, or if these two jurors were excused, was that going to effectively end in a mistrial, given that there had to have been agreement to go with 10 jurors?
I believe that there were alternates.
Okay.
So there may not have been a direct mistrial, depending on what the trial court found out. And my answer to you, Justice Basil, is that I agree it is a judgment call. I just don't agree that it's a reasonable one.
Okay.
All right, thank you, counsel.
And with that, I will yield the rest of my time to the court.
All right, counsel. I was writing a note.
May it please the court. My name is Joshua Llewellyn, and I represent the state. Let me start off just by answering Justice Birdwell, your question. There was one alternate on this jury, but that alternate was installed as a member of the jury right after this whole incident, when the jurors were admonished about not discussing the case. And the reason was because one of the jurors actually recognized that she may have known a family member of the victim, and she was so focused on trying to figure out how she might have known the victim or the victim's family that she couldn't focus on the case, and so that juror was excused. So at that point, there were only 12 jurors and no alternates. And that occurred right after this whole incident of them finding out about that situation. But I'll just pick up right off there on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Certainly, as the court has already suggested, there is definitely a risk in asking jurors about a personal conversation that they had at lunch, especially in this case, since it was a defense-coded issue. You're talking about a defendant's right to testify, and that's something that is difficult for any member of the jury to not think about if the defendant does not testify, and notoriously so. And they're having potentially the judge start asking them questions about that very thing, magnifying the issue in their minds. But regardless, it is quite reasonable to assume that defense counsel at the time knew his client was going to testify and therefore it wouldn't be an issue. But I want to bring up more of
anything in the record whatsoever to indicate what defense counsel was thinking with regard to had your client would know whether he was going to testify. So no motion for new trial to bring that to the court's attention or anything of that nature.
Correct, Your Honor. And there is nothing in the record that actually tells us what defense counsel was thinking. That's typically why we handle
your client, her client.
Sorry,
the defendant would have known.
I understood, Judge. Yes, there's nothing in the record to show what defense counsel was thinking. That's typically why we handle these issues on a post-conviction application for writ of habeas corpus or in motions for new trial, so that we can actually get this strategy directly from the mouth of defense counsel and he can explain why he was doing those things. Typically, defense counsel will not divulge their trial strategy in front of the state in the middle of a trial. But I think the context of what happened is important here, and this is not really something that I've fleshed out in my brief very well, but right before all this happened, you had the victim testifying, the state passed the witness, and the defense counsel started cross-examining the victim. During that cross-examination.
So the break was actually during cross?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And during that cross-examination that took place before the lunch break, the victim testified about several things that defense counsel was asking her about, notably some things that she was searching in her phone that they got from the phone dump of the victim's phone. And the victim lied about several things. And right after lunch, the defense counsel, knowing that the state was going to tell the victim, hey, you need to be honest, the defense counsel was about to confront the victim and on that and catch the victim in a lie. If defense counsel had, hypothetically speaking, successfully obtained a mistrial in this case on the basis that the jurors were considering the defendant potentially not testifying, even though he potentially was going to testify, the better outcome than a mistrial would be an acquittal. And as the record demonstrates, right after this whole hearing, when cross-examination resumed, the victim admitted to lying on the stand. And
so in other words, so you're saying that the testimony from the victim concerning what she had actually searched on her phone was developed by defense counsel on cross-examination and had not been anticipated during direct examination by the state.
Yes.
And so if in fact he obtained a mistrial due to the jurors breaking the rules with regard to discussing not only testimony, but also discussing whether or not the defendant would actually testify in his own defense, had that ended up being a mistrial, then the gotcha moment might have been lost, and therefore in a retrial the state would have anticipated that and dealt with that in the direct examination on retrial, and it would not have been something that could have been developed and the gotcha occurred during cross-examination. So he'd set it up, but if he loses the setup if there's a mistrial.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. And especially in light of the fact that the state would already anticipate that the victim might lie about something. I mean, it's possible the state might have anticipated that the victim's search history would be discussed during cross-examination, but they probably never could have predicted that the victim was going to lie about it, and they probably did not adequately prepare the victim to say, hey, if they ask these questions, make sure you tell the truth about it. But as the situation
she
was.
She lied during cross-examination.
Yes.
And she was going to be confronted with that lie after the lunch break by defense counsel. But if there's a mistrial, that moment never occurs.
Right, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
And that's not something you argued in your brief. That's something you're arguing now.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's supported by the record.
It's supported by the record. And the fact of the matter is, none of us know what the defense counsel's strategy could have been. It could have been that he was anticipating this gotcha moment, that he was anticipating getting the victim to admit on the stand that that there was a lie. It could have been because he didn't want to risk offending the juries or the jurors that had that discussion by having the judge question them specifically about talking about the defendant not potentially not testifying. But regardless of what his reasoning is, without actually hearing that from defense counsel himself, we can't on appeal now judge his actions and say, well, he didn't have a reasonable strategy in asking the court to not discuss or to not ask those questions of the jurors. And
well, basically, right now you're making an argument that impeaches your own witness in order to avoid a reversal on appeal based upon ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, yes, I think defense counsel effectively impeached the state's witness. I think that's what happened.
Because the theory was that she was more sophisticated even at her young age because the searches that she engaged in indicated a certain degree of sophistication with regard to matters sexual. And then she lied about it, and therefore there would be some type of consciousness of guilt with regard to whether or not her story was, in fact, true or fabricated.
Yes.
And that would be the theory of the cross-examination and the gotcha moment.
Yes, that would be the theory. And obviously, the jurors weren't convinced by that, but it doesn't mean that the strategy would not have been reasonable if that, in fact, was the strategy of defense counsel. But the whole situation and how it laid out, it wasn't just something happened in court and defense counsel failed to object. Defense counsel affirmatively asked the court, no, please don't ask the jurors questions about this. Instead, just give a general admonishment. That screams from the record, I have a reason why I'm asking this. You know, it's not like he just overlooked something. He had a reason why he was asking this, and we can't say that he was ineffective without asking him what that reason was. But regardless, the defendant testified. And, you know, it's not even 100% clear on the record that the jurors were in fact talking about whether the defendant would testify. That's potentially what they were talking about. The record's not.
There was sufficient information that the attorney who overheard whatever it was he overheard understood it was a sexual offense of some type, which is why the question from the bench was, is this the only sexual offense being tried in the courthouse today? So that he could narrow it down to, yeah, there were jurors from this particular case. And then he confirmed that by the description of the jurors.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there had to have been some overhearing of substantive matters with regard to what was going on in the courtroom, in the trial, for the attorney who overheard to be able to narrow down what court he needed to tell what he had overheard.
Yes, and certainly there was some information with regard to that, but as far as the actual substance of what he heard in the conversation, he just said, I heard them talking about whether or not somebody would testify about something. And he took that to mean potentially that they were talking about whether or not the defendant would testify. And with a record like that, there's no real evidence that the jurors were actually biased against him. And Ms. Lytle, when she came up here, she said there was some rebuttable presumption of harm. I'm not aware of any law that says there's a rebuttable presumption of harm when defense counsel asks the judge not to ask the jurors questions about an out-of-court conversation that they had.
Well, is this in fact something that's waivable as opposed to systemic error?
Are you talking about the ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
No, I'm talking about continuing with the trial with jurors who have already violated an aspect of what they've been told not to do, which includes talking about whether or not, considering whether or not the defendant is going to testify.
I'll confess that I didn't research specifically the issue of whether it's waivable or not, but I'm fairly confident in saying that if it's merely evidence that a juror might have violated the court's instructions, then I don't think that would be something that is a systemic error. But I couldn't give you any specific law on that matter.
If it is systemic error, is that something that we can look at sua sponte?
At this point, I don't think so, because it was not raised in the brief. And also, even assuming the court were to look at it, we just don't have any evidence specifically that says, you know, especially something that's not here, that's non-hearsay evidence, that the jurors actually violated the court's instructions. We don't know the exact substance of it. We just have some other attorney in the county who said he overheard a conversation.
Well, the only reason I'm asking it is because the trial court clearly wanted to ask these two jurors why they did what they did in violation of his orders. And the only reason he didn't was he was invited basically not to do that by defense counsel, which is where we're getting into ineffective assistance. So the question is did he have an overriding duty, because it was systemic error, not to ask those questions, okay? Or is it something that he could go ahead and said, okay, you don't want me to do it, I don't do it?
Yeah.
That's why I'm asking that question.
I see what you're saying, Judge. I'm not aware of any doctrine in Texas law that says that would be a systemic error, or that the trial court had an obligation sua sponte to do something like that. But I would argue, even in the context of when we're talking about error preservation, if there's something that's a waivable only right, or even an absolute right, oftentimes if the court is only doing something that the defense counsel invited him to do by asking the court to do that, then that's invited error, and they still can't raise it on appeal. So even if it's like a waivable only right, he asked the trial court to do that thing, and so he can't complain about it on appeal. But regardless, as to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I think it's clear there are several reasons why he might have done that. And moreover, because the defendant testified, or appellant testified, there's no real evidence of harm or prejudice. There simply is nothing in the record to show that the jurors themselves were biased in any way. It may even likely have just been two jurors having a conversation about something that they were curious about. If there are no more questions about that issue, I can move on to the second point that counsel discussed. The application paragraph of the jury charge clearly and unambiguously referred to the abstract definition of sexual abuse. I know there was a suggestion that there should have been some sort of tie-in, like a phrase, like as previously defined, but that's simply not something that's required in the case law. The application paragraph specifically says that the jury had to find that during a period of 30 days or more in duration, he committed two or more acts of sexual abuse against the victim, a child younger than 14 years of age, including acts of sexual abuse constituting the offenses of aggravated sexual assault of a child and indecency with a child. So twice the term acts of sexual abuse is stated in the application paragraph. And in
but
order
her
to-
argument is by using the word constituting and then indiscernibly using the overarching phrase language offense, that thereby included of necessity the entirety of the offense of indecency, which did in fact include the touching of a breast.
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand that argument. However, the jury was instructed to read the jury charge as a whole, and courts generally presume that they read the jury charge as a whole. And in order to accept that argument, one has to assume that the jury read indecency with a child, referred back to the abstract definition of indecency with a child, but when they read twice acts of sexual abuse, they did not refer back to the definition of what acts of sexual abuse is. So the idea that just because we didn't copy and paste the definition from the abstract portion into the application portion, the jury did not understand what was going on, that's simply not true. And that's just the error point. As to harm, from the beginning of trial, from voir dire until closing argument, the prosecutor clearly explained that touching of breasts was not a constituent offense of continuous sexual abuse of a child. There was some argument that the state was, in closing arguments, including the idea that breast touching could be an act of sexual abuse, but that's simply a misreading of it, of the state's argument in context. The state was arguing.
Did the state argue the continuing sexual abuse separate and distinct and the indecency count separate and distinct from the continuing sexual abuse? In other words, clearly the state's going to be arguing that we think the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt establishes indecency, which includes the touching of a breast. Okay, so that argument, if you're going to make that argument based on the evidence, that would be in there. Okay, what was done during the argument by the state to distinguish that argument from the continuing sexual abuse argument as to commission of the offense?
So the state during closing argument said that indecency with a child by contacting the breast is a separate offense from continuous sex abuse of a child. And, you know, I suppose it could have been clearer in the sense that the state could have said, look at the definition, it says continuous sex abuse, and active sexual abuse is defined to exclude breast contact. But in the context of the overall argument that the state was making, they discussed the pattern of abuse and listed a whole bunch of offenses. The pattern of abuse did include contacting the breast, but then immediately following that, they say, now let's talk about breast contact. That is a separate offense. You know, it's not something that was dwelled on.
So the global statement that counsel references about touching of the butt, touching of the breast that was made, was that as in an introductory portion of the, here's what, all the evidence that you've heard, here's what the testimony showed, and then we're going to go specifically to the CSA offense, and then we're going to go specifically after that to the indecency offense?
Yeah.
Or was the global discussion in the middle of the CSA argument?
I would say that it was neatly categorized as an introductory, or I mean, the prosecutor was talking about continuous sex abuse of a child, but in the context of the overall argument was saying, hey, this is the overall pattern of abuse, which included acts that were not constituent offenses. I see that I've run out of time, so if there are no further questions from the court, I just ask
Did
that
he get
be
the
affirmed.
Additional minute? All right, thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. Justice Birdwell, to answer one of your previous questions, Article 3622 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure prohibits any person from conversing with a juror about the case on trial except in the presence and by the permission of the court. That, if the defendant proves a violation of that, there is a rebuttable presumption of injury to the defendant, which can warrant a mistrial. That
basically and this goes back to when I was on the civil bench, basically what you're trying to avoid is the jury conducting deliberations before they've heard all of the evidence. That's why you get that instruction in the criminal case. That's why you get the instruction in the civil cases, is that you're not to begin your deliberations by discussing the evidence outside the context of the entirety of the evidence. And if you do, that's why you don't allow
counsel to discuss the evidence during voir dire is because how do you feel about X or how do you feel about Y becomes I need you to deliberate before you hear any of the evidence. So I guess I get back to the question of, does it specifically say in Article 3622 that it creates a presumption of reversible error of some kind? And if it does, how is that met by the state? Or does it impose a duty on the trial court, separate and distinct from the state, to make sure that those deliberations did not begin or influence the ultimate deliberations after all of the evidence has been heard?
The best way I can answer that question right now is
Hughes. And it was convoluted, so.
But I followed you, though.
Okay.
Hughes v. State from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has said that Article 3622 violation does create a rebuttable presumption. I'm happy to submit a letter brief following to answer those more specific questions that you've asked. From this record, because the trial court appeared to be very concerned about this conversation, because he specifically said, I need to find out if they've already made their decision. So going back to the reason that you said that this article exists, in discussing the victim's testimony and her cross-examination and whether or not Mr. Rachel was going to testify, the trial court said, I need to ask them if they've already made a decision against Mr. Rachel because of this. And so that he was wanting to find out exactly.
Again, and this goes back to what I was asking about, whether it's systemic error or waivable only or anything of that nature. What it is there, and is it an independent duty on the part of the trial court to do something that it didn't do, but in this instance it didn't do specifically because it was requested not to do it, although it was inclined to do it? And is there any case law that you're aware of under those type of circumstances where the CCA has said, no, it doesn't matter whether the defendant invited it or not, the trial court had an independent duty under those circumstances?
Right. My understanding of the law is that the Court of Criminal Appeals has twice, once in, well, I can't read my own typing, Del Rio v. State in 1992, and once in Ocon v. State in 2009. Both have said that
Ocon was a mistrial case too, was it not?
Yes. Okay. They both said that Article 3622, which a violation of that is basically violating a constitutional right to an impartial jury. Both of those things have to be raised by defense or they're forfeited.
Okay. So it's forfeitable. Okay.
Right. So I don't believe, if I had found something that imposed upon the trial court.
That would support your ineffective argument that he forfeited something that no reasonable defense counsel would have forfeited.
That's exactly correct.
But he didn't know what the result of that inquiry, the lawyer didn't know what the result of that inquiry was going to be. Three things could have happened. The jurors could have stayed on there. He could have had a mistrial, or those jurors could have been, well, I guess there weren't enough. I don't know whether we would have busted the jury at that point in time or not.
That's the calculus that the defense counsel is making at that point in time.
Which, of course, begs the question, why is this not more appropriately raised in a habeas as opposed to on appeal?
It could be more fleshed out in habeas, and I will concede that. I believe this is something that needs to be considered on direct appeal because in my opinion and in the research that I've done, it's just jarring to allow, and I agree, Justice Bassel, that the trial counsel is weighing, I'm out of time, but may I finish my?
You may.
He is weighing a lot of things in that calculus. A reasonable trial strategy would not put his client's right to an impartial jury at the least, of the least priority. That would be the highest priority, because if he has an impartial juror, that is his utmost duty to keep that from happening. That's why we have voir dire. That's why the judge goes to such great lengths to keep them from researching and making decisions and deliberating prior to time to do so.
Okay. Counsel, do you want leave to file something post-submission, or do you think we've handled it?
I think that I've answered your question.
Okay.
I didn't find anything that would impose upon the trial court its own duty to have inquired into that. If I did, I would have raised
well,
that.
Well, and Ocon's, your citation of Ocon seems to take that, make that a forfeitable right, so.
That's my understanding of the law.
For other reasons, I'm familiar with Ocon, so anyway.
So with that, I will concede any remaining time, which I don't have, back to the court. And thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much. The case is submitted. We appreciate the argument of counsel. It's been very helpful, and we will stand adjourned. Thank y'all.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.